Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Halper.
We got a great show for you.
Yeah.
Really exciting. We have Michael Moore, who's coming in studio to talk
into
to us.
In studio, yeah. In person.
Talk about a lot of things, including a new podcast adventure that he's doing.
Called Rumble.
Super cool. And get his thoughts on the presidential election, which he called correctly last time.
Yeah.
Which everybody has to remember. So a lot to get to. So let's start with Republicans suck, Democrats suck.
Yes, and also obviously rate and review us. Just got to give that shout out. Rate and review us, guys. Just do it. You know what happens if you don't, which is that you let the Pod Save America boys win.
Mm-hmm.
So for this week's Republicans suck, we are going to award it to Tom Fitton, who's from Judicial Watch, which is a nice right-wing organization.
So they're an organization that basically does a lot of public legal filings to try to get hold of documents.
Yes.
Actually kind of an interesting group. I mean, they do a lot of stuff that people should be doing on the other side. More.
Right. I know. It's one of those weird things where it's like we don't want to associate with them. So it'd be nice if people on the left were doing that.
Right. But they, this guy, Tom Fitton, he has a tweet out and it's just funny.
Yeah.
Can we see the video?
Let's roll the videotape.
Hi, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here with the latest on the coup attack targeting President Trump. Well, the House Judiciary Committee did something that will go down in infamy. It passed two sham articles of impeachment in a remarkable abuse of power never seen before in our nation's history.
Okay, can we stop?
These articles need to be rejected.
So we're not even listening to what he's saying.
No, so let me present. We want to give him a shout out because why he sucks is, as you can see, dear viewers and listeners, we'll describe it for you. The man is has his hands on his hips, and his right shirt cuff is there a word for that? I mean, it's.
I think he's got a clothesline behind it that's pinching the.
Oh, you
either
do?
That or it's rolled up all the way up. But I don't think
it's not rolled. I think maybe he. Oh, you think he actually did something there? What we're trying to get at is why. That's the debate.
Why is this? The sleeve is just a lot tighter around the bicep on the one side than it is on the
and
other side.
And you think
side.
It's an actual clothespin?
I don't know. I guess that's a conspiratorial interpretation.
I mean, what it could be is I think it just he kind of cuffed it up. He put it up higher. The whole thing is weird. The stance is weird. It looks like he's selling you a product, like a seen on TV product.
Yeah. No. He's in a left-handed boxing stance right now.
Oh, that's yeah.
Yeah. So he's leading. You know, he's jabbing with the wrong hand. But the it's just the bicep is just so prominent in this. I don't know. Look, the man works out. There's nothing we can say.
I know. He really wanted to show that off, too.
Yeah. All right. Democrats suck this week.
Yep. Repeat offender.
What a surprise. We got a repeat offender. We were going to go with Barack Obama talking about how old people need to step aside.
Old men, yeah.
Old men.
He's so woke. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, which was kind of interesting. But we're back to Neera Tanden, who tweeted this great thing. What you will never hear on this website, but is true in this poll and in previous ones, building a wall is more popular than single-payer health care.
And she cites a Fox News, something from FoxNews.com.
Fantastic.
There's so much to unpack here, right? First of all, what is she saying? Build that wall?
So we should support the wall, I guess.
I think she's so vindictive and petty that she's just trying to take a dig at single-payer.
Right.
I mean, this is also why she was really pushing against single-payer, because she wants universal health care, which is a very vague, slippery term, which just means that there's access, you know, one of those other terms like access. So she wants like everyone to have the right to be underinsured.
Right. Also, she's wrong about the poll thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there are numerous polls that, I mean, there was a poll in 2018 by Kaiser, I think it was, that showed, you know, their number was 70% favoring Medicare for All. Now that was, it was broken down like 42% strongly in favor, and then a smaller percentage somewhat.
Right.
But it's certainly popular, the idea.
Yeah.
And the, you know, for her to talk about this as being something that's less popular than the wall, I don't know what the point of that is, and B,
I know. What is the point? What's the takeaway? And again, this is someone who will always criticize anyone who says something that anyone on the right says, even if we're saying it for very different reasons.
Mm.
Right. Parroting right-wing talking points. So what does she think she's doing? And by going on to Fox News, of all things.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's such hypocrisy.
She's great. She's great.
She's so great. And
I hope somewhere in one of the legalized states that there's a Neera Tanden strain that is being sold in weed stores.
What do you mean strain?
Like a Neera Tanden brand weed.
Oh, sorry. Weed store. I agree. Yeah. Also, I like her Twitter feed because you can find a plethora of Iraq war advocates. So she retweets William Crystal, Max Boot. She really is the liberal Trump. She like won't. She doubles down. She tweets at odd hours. I mean, I kind of do too, but I'm not the head of like the biggest liberal think tank.
Right. She's the liberal Trump. But Trump is occasionally funny.
Oh, she's the humorless liberal Trump. I mean, she's on. Well, they're both unintentionally funny, but I like it because she kind of she always like shows her true colors, and she of course like
she's
passive aggressive. That's what she is, unlike Trump.
Yeah.
Like Trump has a real honesty when he goes after like people like Greta Thunberg or whatever.
Right. He just kind of lets it all hang out. Yeah. She's consistent though. She's like movie villain. So we'll try to avoid her in the future.
She's a mean bully, right? She's a bully with all these like followers, literally followers on Twitter.
All right. What do we have for?
Isn't that weird?
I mean, I think everybody saw this.
I mean, I think everyone was exposed to this. So we have a heartwarming story about penis fish washing up on a beach in California. Thousands of creatures resembling penises have washed up on a beach in California. The pulsating creatures are fat innkeeper worms, or Erectus caupo. Although they are a type of worm, they are widely referred to as the penis fish. The worms bury themselves deep beneath the sand, but recent storms have uprooted them, and Drake's Beach, about 50 miles north of San Francisco, has been covered in the creatures. Can you imagine walking onto a beach covered with penis fish?
There's a profound metaphor in here about the insecurity of male attitudes in like the woke era. I don't know what it is. Like everybody's sort of penises are washing up on beaches.
Right.
Don't know what to do with ourselves. I don't know.
The first image that we see of one, I don't know if it's coincidentally extremely penile because it even has a testy, it looks like. A testes?
A testis.
Right. It has a testis. And like some interesting kind of like shaping. We have a great quote from a biologist who said, yes, the physical design of the fat innkeeper worm has some explaining to do, but the fat innkeeper is perfectly shaped for a life spent underground, wrote biologist Ivan Parr. Also, it's eaten, by the way, it's a delicacy in some countries, in I believe East Asia. That is a horrid picture.
It's like a whole beach covered with uprooted penises.
I know. Yeah. They're coming out. They're coming up.
Again, there's a metaphor in there somewhere. I have to work it out in my head.
But is it like liberatory? Are they like coming out in full force and like not silent no more?
It's more like an expression of despair. Right. Yeah. I mean, there is something. There is a protest quality of all this, but it's incoherent.
Is it like it kind of has a mass suicide vibe to it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like it's penises jumping off a cliff, basically.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine eating that?
I've actually eaten horse penis.
In Russia?
In Kyrgyzstan. Yeah.
What was it like?
Not
fibrous?
Tasty. Yeah. But I had to pretend it was good. So.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Were you like, this is the top five best horse penis I've had?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this right up there with all the best horse penis dishes I've ever eaten.
They don't make them like this in the USA.
All right, so isn't that terrible? What I've got is drunk, dangerous Santas. Mm. This was SantaCon.
Yeah.
So I always thought SantaCon, always for me, like rested on the edge of like funny versus abhorrent.
Right.
Right. Well, the first time I really, really noticed SantaCon was back in, I think it was 2014. It was after the Eric Garner decision had come, and there was a big sort of hands up, don't shoot protest in New York. So I was covering that.
Right.
And SantaCon was happening at the same time as this anti-police brutality march.
Was that
march.
The one where they shut down the bridge or a different one?
I don't remember, it was like a clash of these sort of drunken suburban goofs.
Yeah.
And like a very serious thing. And it was just totally, they were terrible.
Yeah,
right? And then on the way home, somebody vomited on my shoes and that was not good. But I think SantaCon has become this thing that's just out of control.
It's been like that for a while, yeah.
But it's gotten worse. We have some video from the recent SantaCon. Can we see number A here?
Exhibit A.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
So this is a big Santa fight in the middle of the street. Oh my God, this is awful. Oh my God, what do you think they did?
It's nine Santas kicking the shit out of each other.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and holding each other up, and then they bang themselves against a car.
Yeah, you got a guy. It's like a scene out of Goodfellas. One Santa grabbing another Santa's head and driving him into a car window. The time to be drunk and out of control and in a Santa costume, I think it kind of passed. It tolls after the age of 30, I think.
Oh, I think like 10. Oh, right? You can't drink then. Forget
right.
that.
Right, yeah.
All right,
it's
30.
A sweet spot.
Yeah, you're
Can
right.
we see the next one? Santa's jumping turnstiles because...
That's no good.
Because that's what Santa would do.
Santa Claus people.
Ho,
that's
ho.
Scary.
And they're saying, ho, ho, ho. And then we got one more here, where the best part here is the expression of the on the face of the guy who's in purple. It's a bunch of Santas being jackasses on the subway.
Oh, my God. And there's a guy. There's some elves, too, right? Are those elves? What are they even singing? So there's a guy.
I can't really even describe what.
Yeah, there's
that
a guy leaning on against the subway door with his hand on the pole, and it's like his head is against the door, like he's
trying to get himself out of the train as it's moving because he wants to get farther away from the caroling.
Yeah.
And the caroling has this really wonderfully like negative. It's not like joyous and inviting. It's.
I mean, there is caroling in general that I like.
Not this.
It could be cute if just little kids did it, but I don't like older people doing it.
Right.
If little kids just dressed up in like a non-alcoholic SantaCon, if little kids just, I guess that's called like Halloween.
Yeah.
Why do I sound like I was raised by like Jehovah's Witnesses or something?
And I know, you
have
sound
no
like you're one of these people who have trapped in one of those Utah compounds.
Yeah, like I don't understand holidays.
It's actually kind of a clever idea. Like if you put on a Santa Claus costume,
right.
you can act like a complete asshole and
right.
nobody will say anything.
Right, exactly,
right?
Yeah.
It's smart.
Yeah.
But it's kind of worn thin at this point.
Right. Very thin. Yeah. Like a Santa's hat.
Okay. A couple quick updates. We got to get to last show we had on.
Cenk Uygur.
Right.
Who's running for Congress.
He was running for Congress. A couple of really wild news stories.
Yeah. Okay. So shortly after we taped our interview with Cenk Uygur. And before we released it, Bernie Sanders endorsed and then endorsed Cenk Uygur.
Right.
Which was very controversial, and of course the New York Times decided to make an article out of it. It's like, regardless of what you think of him, I don't really care if you like him, you dislike him, you may think he's a good candidate, a bad candidate. It's just, there's been a lot of kind of ad hominem attacks on him for saying things in the past that I just think people are being a little bit double-standarded. Let's make up that word. They're showing real double standard in terms of what people are allowed to say. Anyway, one of the pieces on him was from the New York Times.
So one of the things that in the Times piece, one of the things they said was that in an interview with David Duke, when the subject of Duke being a racist had come up.
David Duke said, "I'm not what you call a racist." And Uygur remarked, no, of course not.
And this was done completely deadpan. There was no sense of
the
context. So then it turns out, and this let's look at the video. This is how it actually went.
Name me one anti-Semitic person.
I say that
you can't. David, how could you think you're not anti-Semitic? How could you possibly think that you think the Jews control the world? That's anti-Semitism 101.
I'll give you another quotation.
Kagan is on the Supreme Court.
And when people have a chance to hear me, unmitigated, when they hear me uncensored, and when I have a chance to lay out the arguments, they agree with my arguments.
All right, I think we've given you plenty of opportunity here. Whether we should have, of course, is an open question. But again, thank you for joining us.
I know you're going to get some problems. I think you're courageous to have me on, mm-hmm. I've got a copy, of course, the tape.
Okay,
it'll go out anyway. But I've been on Meet the Press 3 times, and if I could be on Meet the Press 3 times, I think that. Cenk can have David Duke on and have an interview.
Okay, well, we did. We did. For better or for worse, we did.
Recently, even though, I said, they still talk about me, Peckley, every day in relation to Trump or relation to the guy from Louisiana, mm-hmm. it's amazing that I don't do many national interviews anymore. I think the reason is because my arguments are very compelling to an awful lot of people.
Mm,
if they sit down and think about what they say, I think they'll be really surprised.
Okay.
And by the way, you know, I want to make this clear, too. I am not what you call a racist.
No, of course.
I am not.
No,
because I believe that every people have the right to seek the things that...
I mean, he's talking to him like he's talking to like a demented child or something.
You can see from this video, Cenk is clearly disagreeing with David Duke.
Yeah, vehemently.
Vehemently. And talking to him like he's a kid, like you said. Unless anyone thought that that wasn't true... the video that Kyle Kulinski tweeted, you see a mashup of Cenk being very aggressive with David Duke.
In fact, and he's doing exactly what everybody has asked the media to do, like with people like Trump.
Right, which is challenge them, push
challenge
back.
Them literally every second.
Right.
Right. And
so the New York Times basically parroted this talking point that was tweeted.
Right, and then it was days.
Yeah.
Before I think it was 3 days.
Yeah, you tweeted about it, right, Matt?
Yeah. It says, correction, New York Times Politics. An earlier version of this article referred precisely to a remark by Cenk Uygur, a radio host running for Congress. When David Duke appeared on his show and denied being a racist, Mr. Uyghur,
Mr. Uyghur.
I just can't pronounce that word. It was sarcastic when he replied, no, of course not. One thing I want to say about this, there's two things. Normally when you make a mistake, you can see how they happen, right? So, like, I know how this happened. Somebody just looked at the tweet and then didn't check.
Yeah.
But that's something where you would absolutely need to listen to it. Like, you
right.
know, especially if you're going to accuse somebody of making essentially a career-ending kind of mistake, right?
Right.
You know, if you're going to accuse somebody of being a racist on the order of David Duke, you really got to be clear about what exactly the situation is before
right.
you put it out there. And then they must have gotten pushback on this immediately.
Yeah, they got tons. Yeah.
And they didn't correct it for 3 days.
Right.
So that's it's hard to see how that happens.
Yeah.
It's not. I normally try to be a little understanding of how
sure.
journalists, because journalists screw up. We all screw up. But that's a pretty bad
yeah.
one.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been malicious, but we don't know that. I'm just laying out the full range of possibility. It's either a mistake, or it could have been someone, you know. It's not beyond the pale to think that.
I don't think you would intentionally, because this ends up looking worse for the Times in the end.
Yeah, I guess. Although they're so used to just ignoring these things. So you could imagine how it could have been kind of a gamble. It's like, well, we're not going to have to apologize anyway. And he did literally say that. I mean, I'm just offering the counterpoint.
Sure. So that happened. That was an unusual story. Some other things we should talk about.
Right.
Situation.
We got the most owned moments of the campaign.
So,
this is our second segment on that, right?
Right.
We started
so
that tradition last week.
We should talk about the poll results,
right,
which were surprising
right.
to us.
Yeah, very surprising. We offered listeners and viewers the chance to vote on which was the most owned moment. And if we go to that tweet, we shall see what the results were. And the choices were Warren getting a B, or Buttigieg saying no, Biden saying here in Iowa, and Booker saying you're a possum. And the winner is Buttigieg says no at 38%. And Warren getting a beer was the lowest at 14%.
I would have had
28%
that.
And Booker 20.
Yeah, I would have thought the results would have been the
Almost
opposite.
The opposite, yeah.
But maybe it's possible people don't. We're not being clear about the concept. I think when we say most stone moment, I think what we're trying to really express, to me anyway, is that you almost feel high when you're watching it because it's that confusing and messed
okay.
up. I don't know. What do you?
Interesting. Like, well, if we look at the videotape of when you first said this, I thought it was you were saying that Elizabeth Warren, the idea to do the big structural bailey.
Right.
Was an idea that would come from being stoned.
It kind of amounts to the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like the whole, there's just like stonedness sort of baked into the whole
sure, yeah.
situation.
And Buttigieg saying no, that was a reference to whether he would let reporters.
Yeah. Asked if he would stop taking money off billionaires and closed door fundraisers. Mayor Pete answers with a curt no. And this is actually, we actually didn't do this one on in the show last week. So.
Open to having a conversation about opening your fundraisers, and that's a question that reporters have been asking for months now. So I'm wondering, when do you expect to actually have that conversation and give an answer on that?
Again, I don't have a timeline for you.
Well, As the candidate, can you just direct your campaign to open this?
Yes.
And why haven't you done so?
What's that?
Why haven't you done so yet?
There are a lot of considerations, and I'm thinking about it.
Next question.
Can you give us an example of those considerations?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you tell us some of the considerations? No.
I love the way he leaves.
Yeah. So Mayor Pete goes up
yeah.
in the.
Uh oh, he's soaring in the
yeah,
polls.
Yeah, he's going to go up in the most stone moments ranking. So when
Crystal
I'm going to re-release the list. We should talk about some of the. We have a couple entrants for this week. So we're
yes.
going to do a poll question this week on
yeah.
about these two.
Yeah.
The first is Mayor Pete again. This is Mayor Pete responding to a 7-year-old about reproductive rights.
I believe that you make your decision on whether you're going to have a child, and then your decision is made, and the abortion is not part of it. What do you think about that?
Well, thanks for speaking up about this, and thanks for being here. And I wish I was as tuned in to big issues when I was 7 as you seem to be. This is a hard issue for a lot of people because they believe different things. And where I live, people believe different things, including people that I respect. But the way I think about it is that this choice, it's about drawing a line. And we might each, following our own beliefs, have a different idea about where to draw the line. What I hope everybody, or at least most of us, can agree on is who gets to draw the line. And that's the person making the decision. That's the woman in question.
Okay, how do you feel about that? Because as a parent, like, I see a 7-year-old and talking about abortion. And
you know, feel like she was set up?
Well, I just feel like, who's telling this kid about any of this stuff at that age, you know? I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that, but it seemed pretty weird to me.
Yeah, but it was really, she cracked me up. She was also wearing like a kerchief on her hair.
All right. We also have Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
Who once again kind of teed off on a TV host.
I'm wondering, is there a priority? It's like a person who has a house, the roof is leaking, the windows are drafty, the door is falling apart. Is there a priority in terms of spending of all of the things that you just ticked off?
Yes, and that is asking the billionaires to put in 2 cents. No, you give me this face. Look.
And that 2 cents is for what exactly?
Now, to be fair, we didn't see her face.
We didn't see the face.
So she could have given her like an FU face or like stuck her tongue out in theory.
That's true.
That's true. Yeah.
It's still a little. Okay, we're admitting facts, not in evidence here, because we're
rushigating. I'm rushigating
this
it.
This is really about the Amy Goodman thing. You know,
right.
it's a pattern that she's jumping down this road of interview questioners.
Yes.
The only reason I think this is interesting is because one of the things that happens with presidential candidates when they've been on the trail too long, a couple of things happen. Number one is they get tired of being asked the same questions over and over again, and so their patience starts to wear thin to the point where they really can't engage
anymore. Plus they're tired, right?
They're extremely tired, like physically. That becomes a serious problem, especially in the general election. You see this, like the fatigue and the annoyance factor. So, I mean, it's been a problem with a bunch of presidential candidates. I think Gore had a little bit of a problem with that. Kerry had a problem. Like, smart people tend to have a problem with this process because they get really, really tired of listening to people, and they're pre-annoyed. By lines of questioning, and if you can tell that Elizabeth Warren is starting to have a little bit of an issue with that.
Because you think they're more engaged in the substance, and so they're like, they see it as BS as opposed to a more like a smoother politician who's...
Well, they also just don't really enjoy, like, Donald Trump loves the attention, right? So when he goes on television, he sort of just gets off on being on TV. He gets off on being asked about himself. And so it's a fun process for them. Like, for certain presidential candidates, it's like going to the dentist every time they go on the media. And and that is a thing that starts to not be good after a while. It's just something to keep an eye on with Elizabeth, don't you think?
I do. This, for some reason, I was much more sympathetic to her in this one. Because I guess maybe partly because I agree. I'm admitting my own bias. I agreed with Amy Goodman's question. I thought she responded unfairly to Amy Goodman. I think in this one it's definitely not good PR.
Right.
But it doesn't make my moral blood boil.
Right. No, I get that.
But yeah.
Should we do one more quick one? Sure. Let's do Cory Booker crying at the end of his speech.
Frank, I love you, man. I love you. And he seemed to be sitting there in peace, and I start to get up, but then he's trying to speak again. And he says the words.
Please.
His last one's to me. I love you. So I want to leave you with that, and we'll answer some questions now, but just think about those words, his last words to me, I see you, I love you.
He's recounting his somebody he knew from his days in Newark who was a tenant rights person.
Yeah.
I've actually heard the I see you, I love you thing at the end of his speeches before, so it's not like he was suddenly overcome.
Right.
Like, this is something that he's
Yes.
He's given this speech many times, so he's kind of breaking down at the end of this. Right. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. You mean you're suggesting it's slightly disin? It's not the most authentic emotional output?
I feel bad. It's kind of a feeling a little verklempt kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But
I don't know. I guess it's oh, it is stoned. You know why?
Why?
Because he's like, I love you, man.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. It's done.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
We
were just rescued
stoned.
That segment.
Yeah.
All right. Excellent. God, yeah. So as usual, this is the most stoned moments thing. Check Twitter. Check online. I'm gonna sort of re-release the list on this, and we're gonna have a vote on this, and I'll sort of tell everybody where the overall list is
right.
Are
we tweeting it from our accounts?
Okay. So it's Adam Taibbi and at KT Helps.
Yeah. So the debates this week, we didn't know, it wasn't clear whether or not there was going to be one because there was a labor dispute, but they've resolved it. Mayor Pete, of course, was the last person to say he wouldn't cross the picket line. I'm sure he was really upset.
Right.
He probably wanted a one-man debate.
That would be an interesting performance, yeah.
He could debate himself from when he was younger and cool and debate himself today. So one of the people who PBS has tapped to be a debate moderator is Yamiche Alcindor. So I was a little bit disturbed when I saw that Yamiche was going to be one of the moderators because she doesn't have a great record when it comes to covering Bernie. So she's kind of famous for asking Bernie if it was sexist for him not to drop out. Let me just set up how she treats Sanders. There's a lot there. When Sanders spoke at the Apollo during the 2016 primary, she tweeted when she was at this event, this is how she described this guy who interrupted Sanders. John Prince, a community activist, interrupted Bernie Sanders to shout about gentrification, okay? But here's the actual video, which Real Clear Politics had a video of.
Actually, studying Israel for years. Okay, what's the Israel video? As you know, the Zionist Jews, and I don't mean to the community, by that. All right, they run the Federal Reserve, they run Wall Street, they run everything.
Okay, so just to clarify, this is what he said. As you know, the Zionist Jews, and I don't mean to offend anybody, which is touching, they run the Federal Reserve, they run Wall Street, they run every campaign. What is your affiliation to your Jewish community? So the way that Yamiche described that was a community activist who interrupted Sanders to shout about gentrification.
Okay.
It's kind of a whitewashing of a very anti-Semitic trope.
Yeah, for
right?
sure.
Mm-hmm. And maybe it's like, oh, she didn't know that was a trope. She also then tweeted something else. More of protester John Prince saying he wants to know about Bernie Sanders' ties to Jewish real estate owners.
But I'm here to speak truth to power. The giant Zionist Jews own Wall. But we know the answer. So why doesn't Bernie want to talk about it? They're buying the South Bronx. They play a Monopoly. If you're in Bed-Stuy, Williamsburg, you see them. They're playing Monopoly. They're buying real estate and they're selling it 10 times the value.
We get it. Jews running the world. Jewish real estate. Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's fine to show that stuff, but it wasn't really particularly critical of it. It felt to me like, am I reading too much into this? Like, it felt to me she was just like, here he is asking this question.
Yeah, no, clearly that's not the way you would really present that.
Yeah.
You know? In fact, I'm not sure why you would even present it at all.
Right. It's a bit problematic, right?
Yeah.
So there's that. Then she also, to be fair, in her article, she did mention anti-Semitism, but it was weird that she tweeted it that way. A community organizer interrupting him to talk about gentrification and then just tweeting that he wants to know his relationship with real estate. She also then, in 2017, remember there was that shooting where someone who did happen to like Sanders shot some people, including Scalise?
Yep.
So the way that Yamiche covered that story was with an article that was called Attack Test Movement Sanders Founded. That was the headline.
Oh, right, yes.
Okay. And this was very much a hit piece. In fact, it was so much a hit piece that we had Brian Fallon, who was Hillary's comms person, tweeted, a hideous act was carried out by someone who backs Sanders. That doesn't mean Sanders incites or condones violence. Here's just one of the things that she wrote about the shooting. The most ardent supporters of Senator Bernie Sanders have long been outspoken about their anger towards Republicans and in some cases towards Democrats. Their idol, the senator from Vermont, has called President Trump a demagogue and said recently that he was perhaps the worst and most dangerous president in the history of our country. Now, in Mr. Sanders' world, his fans have something concrete to grapple with. James T. Hodgkinson, a former volunteer for Mr. Sanders' presidential campaign, is suspected of opening fire on Republican lawmakers practicing baseball in Alexandria, Virginia.
So, there's a couple of things going on here. When people cover presidential candidates, one of the most common ways of kind of putting your thumb on the scale is when they talk about populist candidates, you know, sort of anybody who is playing to the people as opposed to being an establishment candidate, mm-hmm. they're always described as emotional. Right?
Yeah.
So it's always about you're stirring emotions in the electorate. You're not connecting with them intellectually. They always use words like idle,
yeah.
right? When they're talking about the relationship between people's and the candidate, like there's something unhealthy.
Right, messiah.
Yeah,
messiah
like a
complex.
Messiah complex. Whereas if it's an establishment candidate, it's enthusiasm.
Supporter, right, enthusiasm, right.
So this is something that you're going to see with Sanders always throughout. And I think we should just sort of accept he's just not going to get a lot of good coverage.
Right.
It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. So basically we have this person who has a pretty documented record of being unfair to Sanders, who's going to be a debate moderator. She's covered him in ways that kind of downplayed, I would say, the anti-Semitic tropes that were thrown at him. She's covered him in ways that blamed him unfairly, I would say, for a shooting.
Yeah, I mean, look, again, people who cover campaigns, they have feelings too, and everybody has opinions about which candidates they like and which ones they don't like. I mean, you know, when I cover campaigns, I'm negative about some and positive about others.
But you admit it, which is nice.
I think the issue with Sanders, to a lesser extent, Warren, I mean, that's going to come into play with Sanders, Yang, Gabbard for sure. It's going to be all in one direction for the most part, especially when we're talking about debate moderators. You know, pretty much most of the people who are moderating debates, they're going to be not terribly friendly to Sanders.
What's also interesting is that there was this famous moment during 2016 when Yamiche asked Sanders what he has to say to the people who say it's sexist for him not to drop out, which is like a classic trope of some people say it's a Fox News move, right?
Right, yeah.
And when she asked him that, she then tweeted that he had a test. He was like testy. He got testy. And all these, and this is a cool way to see like the media narrative in motion. All these other places picked that up in their headline, like testy, touchy, bothered. So it became a story about Sanders being bothered by this question.
Yeah, and then just not to interrupt, but that's another classic campaign journalism trope that I've written about before. The candidates that we like, we always we describe them as smooth, nuanced, warm. It's always language like that that suggests something that's like kind of there's no sharp edges to them. Candidates we don't like are pointed, edgy, angry, right? So Howard Dean got a lot of that back in the day. Sanders obviously gets a lot of that. It's just another way of kind of telling people, signaling to people that this candidate is mentally not stable. This candidate
too divisive.
This one is the warm, smooth one who's able to handle things.
Right.
And sometimes they mix two things. Like there's a legitimate story to talk about like the temperament of candidates because that can be something that figures into whether or not the person's going to be able to survive a campaign or do well. But a lot of times when they're talking about edgy and pointed candidates, what they're talking about is the political positions and the rhetoric, right? They're saying that it's just too divisive, these ideas. They're too angry. So that's what they're trying to say, I think, with Bernie.
So, Matt, you
Katie.
Wrote two, not one, but two pieces about Horowitz.
Yeah, about the report by the Justice Department Inspector General.
Yeah, the IG.
Michael Horowitz. So there are two big investigations into the origins of the Trump-Russia investigation. There's one that's being done by the Connecticut Attorney General, John Durham. It's overseen by Bill Barr and the Attorney General. And then there's another one, which is an Inspector General investigation, which is not looking for prosecutions to make, but it's basically investigating a couple of narrow questions. Most specifically, he was looking at the question of whether there was political bias that influenced the opening of the Russiagate probe. But most of what he was looking at was how they got permission to get a FISA warrant on Carter Page, who was a Trump aide, and he found all sorts of problems there. So,
what does FISA stand for again?
The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which most people don't know was passed way back in 1977, which is a law that gives the government the ability to monitor communications without having to get a public warrant to do it, as long as they can assert a national security problem. They can even actually go into your house and not tell you that they've done it.
Wow.
Yeah, if they get FISA authority, there's a secret court, the FISC, the FISA Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, secret judges. You don't know who's sitting on the court. The FBI submits warrant applications to the FISA court, and they're basically never denied. Like in something like 33,000 applications, they've denied maybe half a dozen or maybe a dozen over the years. So they always get permission. They got it in this case against the Trump aide Carter Page. And the major problems with the warrant application were that they used the Steele dossier. And then they also did a really sneaky thing where they double dipped. Like they referred to a news article that used Steele as a source, an unnamed source, and then also referred to Steele.
Right, to make it look like they're citing multiple things.
Yeah, but it was really only one thing. So he found 17 mistakes overall in the FISA applications. But there was a lot of stuff, and he testified on the Hill last week. So I wrote about that. I got a lot of criticism for this because people think that I'm helping Trump here. It's really not. This is not what that's about. For me, this is really all about, so after 9/11, the intelligence agencies, which had been told in the 70s to get out of the domestic politics business, no more domestic spying, no more assassinations, no more secret, warrant authority. And then after 9/11, they got permission to do all that stuff again.
Yeah.
And we gave them all sorts of new tools. National security letters. We beefed up the FISA thing. We let them assassinate again. Like we sort of re-granted the ability, and that now we have this big drone assassination program. And all this stuff is secret. Like for instance, you send out a national security letter demanding access to somebody's internet account. The recipient, the company, is not even allowed to tell anybody that they've received this letter. They've sent out 500,000 of these since 2001, and they get permanent waivers so that nobody ever hears about them. And so for me, the Russiagate is significantly about these agencies have gotten so used to being able to listen to and monitor anybody and stick their nose in anything that they finally kind of stepped into a place where people care about, which is the presidential election, and now we're actually getting to see what these processes look like. And the report was really, really ugly from that point of view. I mean, you read some of it, right?
Yeah, and I read articles about it. I read yours, and then I saw him testifying.
And what did you think about what he was saying?
The irony is that the response from liberals, quote-unquote liberals, who are the ones who are accusing Trump of being anti-constitutional, playing fast and loose, destroying our traditions, they have to be consistent. Like, if they care about rule of law and they care about international law and they care about democracy, they should care about this stuff. And I don't expect that from the intelligence people.
Right.
I do expect it from some liberals who were even mad at Obama when he went back on his word about FISA.
Right. Well, they had the FISA Amendments Act, which was passed during his presidency. Yeah, exactly. Like that's one of the things that's been troubling about all this is that because it's Donald Trump, because it's Carter Page, who's, for liberals, not a terribly sympathetic figure. But the idea that you can get permission to like secretly go and listen to a person for a year and have that permission renewed four times by a court on basically bogus evidence. I mean, it was presented, a lot of what the evidence against this guy was in the Steele dossier, which turns out to have been, and that's the other part of this report that was amazing. Like, the P tape.
Yeah.
That was a big story in this country, right? I mean, a lot of people took it seriously. It really dominated headlines for a long time. We find out in this report that it's based on one subsource in the Steele report who completely refuted the story when he was interviewed by the FBI. He said that it was a conversation made over beers in jest, and that when Steele tried to get him to confirm it or corroborate it, he said that he couldn't. And Steele says Horowitz says the corroboration was zero.
Yeah.
So that whole story turns out to be bogus. And, for me, the other part of this is the press. Like, there's lots and lots of stories that came out of all this. It's not just about little Carter Page. It's about all the stories that came out of the research into this guy, from the P-tape to the, you know, the sexual blackmail, the compromise, the file on Hillary, the idea that there was a secret connection between Alpha Bank and the Trump campaign through a server, the idea that the Russians vetoed Mitt Romney as a Secretary of State. I mean, there are lots and lots of news stories. It all came out of this, and they were leaked, you know, by the intelligence agencies, and everybody ran with it. And now nobody wants to go back and say, okay, that was not good.
Yeah, and I mean, I say this a lot, which is that you don't have to like Trump or Carter Page or any of his, you know, lackeys or people to be bothered by this.
Right.
That's what's so disturbing.
It has nothing to do with it. They're almost irrelevant to the whole story.
Yeah, that's the whole thing about liberalism, right? You're supposed to, I may not agree with you, but I'll fight to the death to defend your right to say something.
Right.
And then, of course, it just makes Trump look better to his supporters, or even, I think, probably people who are on the fence about it, when they see, oh, wait, why are these people picking on him? Or they're saying one thing, doing another. And that's
another thing. So I get this all the time from people. They're like, oh, you're helping Trump, right? And I'm like, well, okay, the CNN, MSNBC, The Washington Post, The New York Times, they gave Trump a huge gift by piling onto all these stories that blew up in their faces because he's validating,
they're validating the
fake news thing.
Yes.
So every time here's what happened with these stories that was bad, like from a journalism perspective. When in the report, it comes out that as early as January 2017, the FBI had a pretty good idea that the Steele dossier wasn't right, or that it was really, really problematic. But months after that, they were leaking to papers like the Washington Post that there was probable cause to believe that Carter Page was an agent of a foreign power. So months after they knew that probably wasn't true, or was at least very questionable, they were telling this to reporters. Reporters were running it, you know, because they couldn't see the source material and they didn't bother to demand it.
Yeah.
They ran it, and for years now, those stories were out there, and now they don't want to go back and fix it. And Trump supporters are going to look at that and say, you know, these people just aren't, you know, they're not going to be fair. They're not going to be right. And so it's a win for them.
It's also not fair if they care so much about helping Trump. Like, it would be nice if people like you didn't have to focus on this and could focus on the things that Trump is doing that is, like, you know, illegal or immoral or wrong.
Right.
Instead of having to, which you should, and people need to do this and journalists need to do this, and instead of, like, checking the work of journalists, which is irresponsible, like, they're forcing us to not defend Trump, but kind of defend certain processes.
Right.
Processes. And so if they really cared about, like, I'm happy to go after Trump as a
progressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to be talking about him cutting off food stamps or selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, the tax
NAFTA
2.0, the stupid Space Force thing, you know, the $750 billion defense budget. We could be talking about all that stuff.
Yes, exactly. Which would actually be not only morally compelling, but actually effective in terms of the resistance.
Yeah, I think we all thought this after 2016, that after Trump won, there would be this big come to Jesus moment,
right,
that the party would focus on stuff that mattered. Instead, they poured all their energy into this thing, which is blowing up in their faces. And, you know, I have to admit, like, I personally, it just drives me so crazy to follow it that I've probably overfocused on it a little bit. But
it's like me and the Bernie bro stuff.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But it's when you do stuff like that, it's not like people don't see it. They see it, and it's why this isn't moving the needle for people.
Right,
you know? So one last point about this, which I think is important, and really the Horowitz report really speaks to. When you talk about the enhanced tools that we gave to the intelligence community during the war on terror period, one thing you have to understand is none of them are really applicable unless you can assert a connection to a foreign threat.
Yeah.
Right? So all these tools we give them to listen to us secretly, to demand access to our emails, send these national security letters to get access to our, you know, to our medical records, bank accounts, whatever, they have to be able to say there's a foreign threat there, whether it's terrorism or some other foreign thing. So this Russiagate is kind of a poster child for how they do this, right? Without the Russia angle, you can't domestically spy. You can't get secret authority to listen to somebody like Carter Page. And so this story,
it has to be externalized.
Yeah, if you notice, a lot of the action takes place overseas.
Yeah.
There are incidents in Great Britain. You know, the the thing that precipitates the whole investigation is a conversation in a bar in London. There are all these foreign connections that come into play. There's two things about that. One, it gives them the authority, which I just mentioned. The other thing is counterintelligence investigations. The judicial review is a lot less, right? Like if you're trying to get discovery in like a criminal case, all they have to do is say that's a national security thing. We can't turn that over, right? So once they put it in that part of the investigative world, you can't see it. It's not visible to the ordinary person. Like a judge can't order them to tell you, what their reasons were for getting a warrant or this or that. That's why this story, I think, people won't see it yet because it's about Trump, but it's going to be highly illustrative of problems that we're going to have later when they do this too much. They already do it too much with foreigners and Muslims and all kinds of other people.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It also kind of highlights how casually accepted and acceptable Islamophobia is, especially among people who like to pride themselves for being open-minded or woke or tolerant.
Right.
It really is. It's just kind of baked in there. I don't think they even think about it.
Right. I mean, I think if you're, for most Muslims in this country, the idea that people can go in and listen to you or check your bank accounts or your medical records or whatever it is, they accept that. They understand that.
Yeah, because it was so disproportionately used against them.
Right. But this is the first time that I think for a lot of sort of middle-class white Americans, the first time they've really seen this.
Yeah.
And so it's a new story to them, and we're just digesting it on partisan lines.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you don't like Trump, you don't care.
Right. But later, eventually, people are going to care about this.
Yeah,
I guarantee.
Yeah, because they'll come back to bite you in the ass. Yeah. Well, yeah, you're getting a lot of love for that beast.
Right, yeah, yeah. No, it's great.
Why do people talk to you on Twitter like they know you or you know them or you're invested? They're like, really, Matt, I used to respect you, but what happened to you? It's so condescending.
Yeah, what happened to you? No, I get that a lot. But, you know, look, this is... It's just one of those things that happens. Also, another thing people don't realize, we can only really focus on a couple of things.
Yeah.
Like, there's only so many really complicated stories you can really follow at any one time. So, you know, this I've spent a couple of years on this. It's just...
This is your beat,
It's one of my beats, yeah, so...
So on today's show, we have a very exciting interview.
Very exciting.
Michael Moore, filmmaker.
Fantastic.
You may have heard of him. Did you see Roger and Me?
So I saw Roger and Me like a million years ago when I was in Russia, believe it or not. And I just remember never being angrier than I was after I watched that movie. I think a lot of people had that experience. Sort of a great pioneering, kind of groundbreaking movie. And he's made so many great ones since then. In fact, I really liked some of the more recent ones.
Fahrenheit 11/9 was great.
Yeah, When Do We Invade Next?
Or, yeah, Where Do We Invade Next?
Where Do We Invade Next? I thought was a really cool movie that I'm looking forward to asking him about.
Yeah.
All right, terrific. So let's talk to Michael Moore.
So I have an apartment in Michigan. I have an apartment here on the Upper West Side. And my apartment here is on top of a movie theater. And my apartment in Michigan is two doors down from the movie theater that I restored and now run for the town.
Oh, wow.
Like a nonprofit movie palace.
Oh, that's excellent.
So you're on 84th or 68th?
Yeah, the Lowe's 84th.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah.
I grew up on 78th, so. I think I may have seen, how long have you been there?
Which slippers were I wearing when you saw me there?
I remember, but is this a fake memory? Or
no, it's not a fake memory. I actually, after I sold Roger Me to Warner Brothers, a third of the money went to taxes. A third of it, I set up a foundation to help other filmmakers out.
Oh, that's great.
And then I kept the final third and bought an apartment at that time, which was, $300,000, some crazy number, which was crazy at that time for me because I had just finished my stint on Michigan unemployment, so I was making $98 a week. So any of this money was just so crazy. But no, I bought an apartment in there, and then 6 years later moved in upstairs a few more floors, and have kept it because I've tried to work in Michigan doing what I do. It's hard to find, you know, the crews and a couple of films. I've actually moved the New York crew there for a year.
Oh, wow.
Flintstone,
yeah, I like that.
Oh, wow, yes. Well, that would be a... If you ever do go to Flint, I'm sorry to say, you do have to be careful about the water. And you have to bring in your own bottled water. I would never drink. And I wouldn't eat food that was prepared with water there either. The thing that you'll hear in the news is that they are fixing the problem. They are tearing out the old pipes and putting in new ones. But the what they're tearing out are the pipes going down the middle of the street, what's called the main line, the main pipes. But every house has a series of pipes going into each house.
And there's no way they're going to be able to.
And they're ruined. And then there's all the internal plumbing that is ruined inside each house. It's such a catastrophe. It can be fixed. We know the science. It's not rocket science. It's just plumbing.
It's money. Yeah.
But it's money.
Right.
And really, do you want to spend that kind of money on a black city?
Right. I mean,
seriously, come on, fellow Americans, really.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And they're black people. There was like, what are they going to say? What are they going to do? You know,
well, they're already doing it.
You've already poisoned their children.
Yeah.
They already feel such despair. And the sense of having any power. You know, African Americans, especially in places like Flint and Detroit, don't have the money to contribute to candidates, don't have the means to have any real say in the way we structure our political system. So trust me, and I don't know if you know what other cities are like, the wealthier cities in Michigan, but if the water had been poisoned in Bloomfield Hills or Grosse Pointe, Ann Arbor, trust me, this would have been fixed within 30 days.
Yeah.
And somebody would have gone to prison for it. So the fact that no one's gone to prison, the fact that the water is still messed up, it's such a heartbreaker for me. I don't know what to do about it. I remember a couple years ago, I really thought, you know, I should just see if Trump would privately meet with me. And I would go in there and I would say to him, okay, look, you and I are about as opposite as things can get. And my mission is to remove you from this house that you're currently occupying. But if you'd like to be remembered for something good, you know, if there's one thing you know, it's construction. You know, I even have a belief that you could operate a backhoe. You know, you should go to Flint and announce that you are here to fix this problem.
You could even pitch that to Trump as a win over the Democrats.
Exactly, that's what I was thinking. You could be like, humiliate Obama when he went there and said the water was good.
Yeah. Why do that?
Why do that? Why help out this Republican governor who hopefully was or still is on his way to prison for this? Why? You know, and all I can think of from what we know about Obama and from me having, you know, read both of his books is that he's very much of the sort of an elevated Rodney King method of can't we all get along? And that, you know, at various points in this water poisoning in Flint, people, it's been pretty close to a bit of a rumble, so to speak, no pun intended for what I'm doing now. But it really, the potential for violence, the potential for an uprising, I don't know if either of you have kids, but you have, okay. So
Matt,
if how old is your child or children?
6, 4, and 2.
6, 4. Okay. So tonight I sneak into the house, and while you are asleep, I poison all three of them.
Yeah, okay. Wouldn't go over well. Yeah.
Wouldn't go over well with you, would?
Right.
What would you do to me?
It would be totally irrational. Let's
if you
put it
walk,
that way.
If you woke up and saw me there poisoning the kids.
Kill you, probably?
Well, I think you have a legal right to kill me.
Oh, yeah.
I think you do. I hope you wouldn't, but nonetheless, that the fact that, just think about this, that all these parents have had their kids. You know, why I'm focusing on the kids is that lead in water under the age of 6 years old causes such permanent brain damage, there is no way to reverse it. There's no medicine to take. There's no nothing. These kids are damaged. One of the big ways that they're damaged is they lose 10, 20, 30 points of their IQ. That will be that way for the rest of their lives. As they're going into adolescence, they're going to have there's going to be a lot of emotional things being triggered by the lead that's in their system. And so the parents, the schools, they'll have various discipline problems that they otherwise wouldn't have had if these kids hadn't been poisoned. I just don't understand how it is that it's one thing if it was an accident. Okay, so let's impeach the governor for incompetence.
Sure.
But once the governor knew, once he was told that the water was poison, at that very second he had to have, his responsibility was to order a shut off of the water.
Yeah. Right.
And they and to get the bring in the Army Corps of Engineers, bring in the large water horse trucks, what they call that just are nothing but water. And these trucks essentially would go up and down the streets every day, filling up water tanks for people so that they would have fresh water, at the very least. That didn't happen. Once the governor's people knew, they decided to keep quiet about it. And again, I can't get around the racial explanation for this. That had these been white people, with money, your self-interest, if you were a government person in charge of this stuff, just your self-interest would be like, I am going to get fucked for this. Because white people with money, fuck you. And you're gonna act immediately. But black people with no money, what's going to happen to me? I mean, I'm not saying they want black people poisoned, but it's kind of like, okay, we've got some time. We'll figure this out. We'll keep it quiet.
It's not urgent.
Not urgent. No. Why would it be urgent? They're black. And I'm sick of. I refuse to participate in post-racial America. I refuse to say because we elected Obama that suddenly that means everything's okay. White people have changed. White people have not changed. Two-thirds of all white guys voted for Trump. That means anytime you see three white guys walking at you down the street toward you, two of them voted for Trump. You need to move over to the other sidewalk because these are not good people that are walking towards you. You should be afraid of them.
And the third one probably says, I'm thinking about voting for Trump. Right.
Yeah, the third one is you and me.
Right.
We're traitors. We're traitors to our race. That's how they see us, too, by the way.
Right.
You know, we've been debating whether or not to go to Trump's rally in Battle Creek, Michigan tomorrow night. I love that it's in Battle Creek.
Yeah. Right.
But you know, I know Battle Creek really, really well. It's the city that invented breakfast, as we know it.
Yeah, it's on the back of every cereal box.
Yes, right? Both Kellogg's and Post are there in Battle Creek. And so we actually got tickets to get in.
Have you been? I mean, when was the last time you were at one?
At a Trump rally?
Yeah.
Well, this is a longer story, but my crew, the very first one he had to announce he was running in 2020, in the beginning of 2017, 1 month after he was inaugurated, he had that first big rally down in Florida. So I sent my crew in there. I knew I probably couldn't have snuck in there because I still look the same way I've always looked.
Yeah.
So, but they went in there and they filmed, they got some incredible footage. And a year or so later, when the mail bomb guy from Florida was sending mail bombs to the Obamas and the Clintons and Robert De Niro and Soros and all this, and he had a big picture of me on the side of his van with a bullseye over it. Not just me, but others. And frankly, to be honest, out of respect to him, while everybody else had the bullseye over their face, he put it over my shoulder.
Oh,
and
wow.
I thought, okay.
Yeah.
So, and two things I thought. Number one, that's a really good picture of me. It's hard to find a decent picture of me. So he picked a good picture, and then he didn't put the bullseye over. He put it over here.
So it's twice.
So
Two solids
on that. And but then one day at this apartment above the movie theater here in Manhattan, where I have my New York apartment, there's a call from downstairs that says, the FBI is on their way up. And I'm like, oh, no. What do you think? If you heard that.
I did something wrong, and they've got me.
They've got me for something I didn't do.
Right, yeah.
But it's Trump time. There's two FBI guys and a New York City detective. They said, can we come in? I said, first mistake, yes. No, you never say yes. Step out in the hall and talk to them.
Yeah.
Right.
They come in, and they said, okay, look, here's the deal. You know, we just arrested this man.
But you look great in his photo of you.
Which they mentioned.
Yeah.
They saw it too, because they were now looking at me in person, and they're thinking, "Wow, this isn't the same guy in the van. He looks fucking great." So I said, "We wanted to check to see if you've been sent your bomb, because it's clear he's sent you a bomb, because we've got his computer, and there is more research on you than anybody else.
Wow,
that's pictured on his van, and more than anybody else who's actually already received the bomb."
Wow. Yeah.
So they had already gone down to the, what's that on 83rd Street between Columbus and Amsterdam? There's a postal station for the Upper West Side. So they'd already gone down there to take the dogs and sniff around. And talk to all the postal workers what to look out for. They wanted to know where else, who, you know, what other addresses he would have. And I said, well, my, I gave him family members. Yeah, I gave him my apartment in Michigan. I gave him my agents. And then I stopped for a second. I thought, you know what, don't bother with the agent.
Right.
If the bomb goes there, that's really where it's supposed to go, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, you're like, in fact, let me make sure I put down the right suite number.
Yeah, yeah. Or they got the name. I don't make sure he's got the name spelled right.
Right, you know, the 10% comes back to me or the other. Yeah.
Well, yeah, well, that'll all get lost. I will, whatever I'm making this year, I figured I'm going to keep. Because in the tragedy, in the wake of the tragedy, there's no way they're going to be worrying about collecting their 10%.
Yeah.
So anyways, they couldn't find the alleged bomb.
Wow.
And they were kind of stunned by it. But I said, but the guy's a fuck up. And he was right because he didn't know how to build a bomb.
Right.
No bomb went off.
There's probably a few Michael Moores in the country. Do you think maybe he's
said it to a different it's quite a common name, yes. Basil, my producer, said that, you know, I wonder if he was at any of the Trump rallies that we went to. That maybe we filmed him. They start going back through the footage and damn if he wasn't right there in the front of the rope line.
Really?
Screaming for Trump and, you know, make America great and all that. There he is, right there into our camera. And it was like, wow, this is really something. So anyways, I wrote a public letter to him. I didn't know how to get a letter to him. They were holding him here in the Jeffrey Epstein Memorial Jail in downtown Manhattan. I thought, you know, I'll send him a letter and basically said, hey, you know, I'd love to talk to you. You know, I'd like to know why I ended up on this list. Cause I've been on other lists before. There was one time a guy who was building a fertilizer bomb to blow up my home in Michigan. And, when they raided his place, I was on the hit list. In fact, I was the top of the hit list. In fact, in his diary, he actually called it hit list. Makes it easy to find, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, like when I make lists, I have like codes.
Yeah.
Like, so you'll never know.
Hit list, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like who's on this list.
Yeah. You know, my criminal conspiracy list number one, right? Right. Yeah. Make it easier for
me. So on hit list. So I'm at the top of the hit list. So it's Michael Moore, Janet Reno, Bill Clinton's attorney general, Hillary Clinton, Rosie O'Donnell, and me. Well, my first question when the cops showed me this was, how did I make the lesbian list? I mean, I'm honored. Don't get me wrong.
Of course,
I mean,
it's a good list to be on.
It's a great list to be on. But seriously, and why am I at the top of the lesbian list? And of course, for people who are listening to this, you're, wait a minute, Hillary's not a lesbian.
Right.
I'm making fun of all the crazy right wingers who like to think of her and talk about her in that way. So I'm
okay, it's a use of irony.
Yes.
Irony.
Right.
And you know how you have to.
We have the woke button. You can hit it.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you're gonna,
it's funny when you say that about irony. The first time I was on TV was on the Today Show with Roger and me, and it was Jane Pauley's second to last day as host of the show. And so we're in a commercial break. They've sat me down. I'm really nervous. I've never been on national TV before. She leans over to me. Now, her husband is Gary Trudeau,
right, yeah.
Doonesbury.
Mm-hmm.
And she leans over and she says, my husband wanted to tell you that he's sorry, but you're going to have a very hard time if you continue to make movies like this.
Wow.
And I said, why do you say that? She said, because 50% of this country has no clue when the ironic statement is made.
Oh, yeah.
And you have just chosen. I said, I know exactly what you're saying, because I literally grew up across the river, across the lake from Canada. And of course, Canadians are great satirists
and use irony all
the time. So we would watch Canadian TV, and I think whatever that was that I understood from growing up so
CTV
close.
CTV and all that. Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Oh, so
yeah.
Close to Canada and
to
Canadians. And I had Canadian relatives, too. And they're very dry, their sense of humor.
Yeah.
It's not our sense of humor.
Right.
It's more of an Irish-British
droll
sense of humor. Yes, yes. And vicious without seeming to be vicious.
Yeah.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about that because, like, a lot of you've talked about this in the past. I mean, obviously, you deal with a lot of tough subjects in your movies, but you always you make a point of using humor,
yes.
Right? Like, how important do you think that is in order to get people to pay attention to something they otherwise wouldn't take in?
I think it's one of the best vehicles to help deliver whatever message it is you're trying to deliver. There's enough darkness in this world. and we are really in a dark, dark time. So people get it. They're depressed. They're depressed enough with what they're witnessing. I mean, if you've traveled the country, the despair, that the malaise that extends across this country, it's. I see it all the time, and I spend a lot of time, and I occasionally will miss a connection in the airport because people just want to talk.
Oh, yeah.
And so I've known for a very long time, and maybe this is part of the Irish that comes from my family, that that you learn to have a sense of humor in order to deal with the tragic thing we call life, especially if you grew up in that kind of Irish household. I also saw that if I developed a good enough sense of humor, I wouldn't need as much alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, it was just kind of...
It saves money, right?
It saves money.
And liver.
And you've seen a couple of the uncles and what happened to them. And so it's like, okay, let's work on the sense of humor a bit. But no, it's an important vehicle. And I wish more documentary filmmakers would use humor, because the subject matter is often so intense, so heavy, so bringing people down. It doesn't work if you've made a film about an important subject and they leave the theater or they turn off Netflix and all they want to do is go get a drink.
Right.
They want to immediately forget what they just saw.
Or they don't want to see it. They don't want to listen to it, or they're not drawn to it.
Just turn it off right away.
Yeah.
So, you know, I saw early on when I was young, and I think any of us who went to high school, wouldn't you rather have been invited over the table where everybody was laughing?
Right.
Where there was one cut up after another, one joker, one Weisenheimer after another. And as opposed to, you'd look over at the depressing table with us gloomy, sad faces. So I think a good way to reach people is with humor. Oh, geez. I'll tell you a story I probably shouldn't tell, but I won't mention any names other than Hillary's. Because I thought the way to win this, in part, would be during the debates, because Trump has such thin skin.
Yeah.
And because it's not a rally, he won't be able to control the microphone. If Hillary would just, if we gave her like a hidden comedy shiv, just something that where she could just go under that thin skin, and just have him implode live on national television. It would be not only great TV, it would show Americans, oh, wow, he is unhinged. Like
man-child.
Man-child, but just totally, boy, he, I don't know, actually be dangerous, because he does not like to be humiliated.
Yeah.
And this would be a humiliating thing. So I called up three, I'm not going to mention their names because we all promised to keep this quiet. We offered this to Hillary and her people, that we would do this quietly. Nobody would know. We would write lines for her. We would help with the debate prep. She had political people writing lines and things. How about myself and some of our top satirist comedian types? And all she's got to do is land one or two of these, and boom. And they turned us down. They were so afraid that if it ever got out, because this comedian's dirty,
okay, right,
and that comedian has said that once, and that, you know, and, well, she's a woman. I mean, she shouldn't be talking like that.
Yeah.
Do you remember what any of the lines were? Did you have any of them written?
And then she went to Howard Stern.
you know what? If you have, yes, I have this written down. I haven't looked at it or thought about it for a while, but we all thought that. The way to approach this is, don't take the normal route. Like, we got to get him to show his tax returns. Give up on that. This is one, if this was going on this year, this is what I keep hearing right now. Just wait till Elizabeth Warren is on the stage with him during the debate. And I'm like, first of all, the fact that you think there's going to be debates.
Yeah.
He's not going to debate anybody. He so knows his game. And we're still playing the old game.
Right.
Yep, there are going to be three debates. And are you fucking kidding me? Anybody out there who's listening to this who thinks there's going to be a debate, that this is going to be a normal year, 2020, think again. This is how he pulls off his victories, too, because we don't see him coming. We don't know what the plan is. I'm telling you, I know this guy.
Yeah.
And he will come up with a reason. whoever the candidate is treasonous, a traitor, anti-American. You know, it'll be that. Or there'll be a national crisis, an emergency. There'll be something. But he is above debating anybody anymore, and he will never allow the control of that microphone switch to be in the hands of anybody but himself. Because when he's in control of it, he's a genius.
Yeah.
He is. You must know this. You, this is your world. His understanding of the room, his way to read the room, and his performance.
Yeah. He's totally is like a brilliant stand-up.
And he has worked on it.
Yeah. Yeah, we've talked about this. He's very Borscht-Belt.
Riffing and,
He comes out in his costume. He's wearing a thug trench coat. You know, he wants to look like a mafia don. Yeah. And the way he now prances on the stage, the way he does mic drop, the way he's got it all down.
Yeah, he does a Mussolini thing where he turns to the side.
Yes.
Kind of paces back. Yeah, that's like a thing that he's developed.
I'm just waiting for just to fold the arms like Mussolini took.
Like I am.
You were one of the first people, though. What did you see in the summer of 2016? Because, I was one of the people covering the campaign in a sea of pundits whose job it is to predict what happens in elections. Literally none of them saw what you did. So what were you seeing that summer? I mean, you talked about it somewhat, but there was a complete swing and miss on that issue among the professional punditry class, and you got the stuff that nobody else did.
Well, because I spend a lot of time in my other apartment in Michigan, Trump signs were everywhere. I didn't see any Hillary signs. I found out later that the campaign in Brooklyn wouldn't send signs to Michigan because, as it was explained to me later after the election, they were afraid that if too many people saw Hillary signs, it would remind them, the Trump people, that they got to get out and vote, and it would inflame the Trump.
Is that a real thing?
That actually happened.
I can't believe they lost.
Nobody.
What a shock.
No, it's right. So she didn't visit Wisconsin at all. She came to Michigan maybe once or twice, but basically stayed away. Here's the thing. She lost Michigan and Wisconsin to Bernie in the primaries.
Right.
If you lost those two states in an election of voters of your people, Democrats, wouldn't that be the first place you go to once you've got the nomination? Go right to the people that didn't want you and convince them to want you. The fact that so many people stayed home, and what the statistics I think have borne out, is that especially African Americans in all three states who are fed up with being lied to for so many years, nobody coming to help, nobody to the rescue in Detroit, into neighborhoods in Milwaukee and Philadelphia. She lost these three states because the Democrats had not been there fighting the fight and making things happen if you were African American. So what happened in Philly, Detroit, Milwaukee, there's your three cities and your three states. She lost Michigan by about 2 votes per precinct. That's it, 11,000 votes. It never should have happened. And even Trump was surprised that he won.
Yeah.
I mean, he was surprised that he won. He thought it was going to go the other way. When he kept saying the election was going to be rigged,
right.
He, in his own narcissism, absolutely believed that the majority of people wanted him and he'd win the popular vote.
Right,
but the Clintons and their evil, nefarious, people that are in their cabal, they would rig it so that Hillary would get the Electoral College.
Right.
And the majority of Americans, who of course wanted him, would be outraged. And that's when he made his famous statement to my Second Amendment people, get ready.
Right.
Because we're going to need you.
That scene in Fahrenheit 11/9 when Obama goes to Flint, I don't think I knew about it when it happened. Did you know about it? It was like big news. I don't know
covered.
If I...
It wasn't covered
it
much,
wasn't covered,
but
right?
That video, the reaction to it, I mean, that was a powerful moment.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. It seemed so nefarious. And it's such a perfect metaphor for what you're talking about, which is how this failure, this utter failure by the Democrats to come, to show up, or if they do show up, to be honest or to advocate for people.
Right.
It was just like the perfect.
I mean, has anything changed since? I mean, that's the question.
Right.
Like the mistake that they went into with 2016 that caused that lack of engagement, have they done anything?
No. And in fact, we voted out the Republicans out of the state capitol last November, and we voted out the two Republican congressmen in suburban Detroit. We booted them all. And we did that because we got two ballot proposals on there. This was our way of thinking it. And I hope people are doing this in some of these swing states for this coming year. We did with ballot proposals. So we wanted to get the youth vote out. So we got a legalized marijuana ballot, not medical marijuana, all this bullshit, just full on, just full on blast, you know, high speed, you know, high octane legal marijuana. That passed by about 60%. We doubled the number of young voters from the last off-year election in 14. They came out in droves for this. The other ballot proposal was a constitutional amendment to make essentially gerrymandering illegal. That it would be a crime if you did any voter suppression or gerrymandering, especially if done on the basis of race, that there were provisions to deal with you. And it completely changed also the electoral system in Michigan. There would be same-day registration. There'd be none of this prove that you're a voter, prove you're a citizen, all that gone. It made it very easy from now on for people to vote. And it set up the commission that's going to take the 2020 census in Michigan. And it is a completely nonpartisan group of people that that has to be, you know, it's like, I think it's 5 and 5. You, the parties, get to recommend, but you have to vet them and you have to prove that they're not partisan. And then there's 5 more, I think, that that body will pick of them for themselves. But it's set up to redraw these maps in a fair way. I mean, and in fact, I did this film Where to Invade Next, and I went to like 10 countries to show how they do things better, really, good, really simple. We went to Austria, but it's not in the film. Austria, like a number of countries, has lowered the voting age to 16. Mm-hmm. And it's had all these wonderful impacts and effects, mainly. What happens is by starting voting at 16, while they're in high school, the teachers bring in candidates, they have debates, they sign them up to vote, they do all this stuff while they're there in school. And what they found, you know, so Austria's done it, Scotland's done it, Brazil's done it, Nicaragua's done it, you know, a few other countries I can't think of right now. They have found in these countries that students who start voting at 16, a larger percentage of their 18 to 25-year-olds show up on election day than in the countries like ours where you don't vote till you're 18. Right. So it starts them out being voter citizens.
Yeah, it sets the pattern.
Sets a habit while they're at that age. It's why in most states, other than New York City here, but most, like where I'm from, you know, you take driver training when you're 15. You get a permit, and then you get a license at 16. Why do we let these little kids drive these cars? Well, in part because we need to guide them while we have them in school to try to make them decent drivers.
Yeah, so they can take driver's ed or the school district
pays for the driver's ed. The community sees it as for its own safety, for the public good, that we should teach that in school, and we need them to start driving when they're 16 so they're better drivers by the time they're out as adults.
I only have my learner's permit, so it didn't work.
Really? To this day?
Yeah. Really? I need to get it. Yeah. I don't know how to drive.
Where'd you grow up? Here in the city?
Upper West.
I know.
Katie didn't know who the Who was until about 6 weeks ago.
No, I knew who the Who was. I just confused them with fish. I knew who they were.
Yeah.
Wow.
Or the Clash.
You know, that's brave that you would admit that.
I know, right? Especially with this guy as a co-host. Yeah.
And you admit that inside of Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Is even more brave.
Well, I stand out. Makes me special. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about that movie, actually, because in your movies, you have a lot of things that are, I would say, unusual scenes, like the people having the party in the prison and Roger and Me, right? That would be like, you're kind of lucky to get something as insane as that, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of your movies, the premise is just going off and filming something that's right in front of everybody's face that the news media doesn't cover, right? Like, you know, somebody going into a Walmart and talking to somebody about what their employment plan is, or, you know, going to visit a Scandinavian prison, asking how people live there. Is there just a scoop that's all around that people just aren't filming in the news?
Yes,
I mean,
every day.
Right? I mean, isn't that
amazing?
Yeah.
Yes. It's why, and I'm so fed up with it. It's this podcast that I started today. It's just the first piece of a number of things I want to do, creating my own media online, and to attempt to do the job that I see every day through my travels, through my own filmmaking, the job that's not being done. I'll give you an example from Roger and Me. There's a scene in there where a family is $100 and some behind in their rent.
The eviction scene.
The eviction scene. They're evicted on Christmas Eve by the deputy sheriff. We even try to give him the money so he doesn't throw them out. I don't want the scene in the movie. I'm not going to be an objective, you know, bystander to this. And when we, the crew, we all pooled the money together to pay the rent and went to hand it to him. And he said, "You're handing money to an officer of the law so that I don't do my job. You want to take a second and rethink this before I arrest you?" Okay, no problem. So he evicts the family. But you have never seen, and before Roger and me, nobody had ever seen a family being thrown out of their home where they literally carry the tree and all the presents out and throw it on the curb. The kids are there. They're crying. The mother is so upset. You've never seen that, and yet it happens, I would say, in most cities. And they work right up until the last minute. They don't work on Christmas Day, but they work on Christmas Eve. And I put that in the film, and people were just, I mean, so moved, so shocked by it. And I'm like, why? Why would you not think that this is happening? And I'll tell you why. Local TV, it's the same all across this country. What's the Christmas Eve, the 6 o'clock or the 11 o'clock news on Christmas Eve at Channel 4, at Channel 7? It's the same three goddamn stories every Christmas Eve. It's some do-good organization is making food for a Christmas dinner for the next day for the homeless, for the poor. It's the
weather report.
That's the third one. Yes. Right, okay. So the second one is they're at the mall where the reporter is kind of yucking it up that the guys, last minute shoppers, and they're all guys, are doing their last minute shopping. And then the third story is the weatherman comes in.
Right.
And he's got on the radar a sleigh and some reindeer. And they're tracking it. They're tracking it for the little kids to watch. Santa's on his way now. He's done with Europe. He's crossing the Atlantic. Pit stop in Iceland or Greenland, depending on, if it's a more modern sleigh. You can get a little farther.
How much mileage,
Yes. That's how we cover Christmas Eve, and then one of the networks is showing either White Christmas,
It's a Wonderful Life,
It's a Wonderful Life,
Miracle on 34th Street,
Miracle on 34th Street, or the Home Alone Christmas one.
It's pretty good. I just saw it with my friend's son. It's kind of good. Home Alone 2.
Home Alone 2, Trump's in it.
Oh, yeah. We didn't let him watch that part.
Yeah. A great movie is Gremlins 2. Trump's not in it, but it's about Trump. Like the evil character that the gremlins are trying to figure out how to go up against the evil builder landlord. It's such a genius film. People know the first Gremlins, but Gremlins 2 doesn't get its due. In the same way that oftentimes the sequel really is actually better.
Yeah.
Wrath of Khan for Star Trek. Star Trek 2 is better than Star Trek 1.
Godfather 2 is a good one.
Godfather is obvious, yes. Yeah. 2 is better than 1.
European Vacation.
Yes, that's good. What is that, 2?
European Vacation is, because it's Vacation European, then
so European,
European's the best.
Anyways, but it's just, don't reject the sequel is all I'm trying to encourage people to. So I constantly see these things, and it drives me crazy that nothing is happening. I mean, my first film came out of the 10 years of me railing against how General Motors was being given all these tax breaks. I go down to the city council meeting, I'd speak out against it. GM would take the tax break. They wouldn't create any new jobs. They would just use the free money that we were handing them to go build factories in Mexico or South America or whatever.
What year did Roger and Me come out?
1989. So 30 years ago. Actually, as we sit here, this is Tuesday. It'll be 30 years this Friday.
Wow.
You came out of the alt weekly world, right? Yes.
I started my own alternative newspaper in Flint, Michigan called The Flint Voice.
Right, but you're kind of a pioneer because alt weeklies are in terrible trouble now, right? But you've moved on to documentary. Are documentaries going to take the place, because there's a lot of demand for it now, right? I mean, is it a way for alternative voices to get in front of audiences in the same way that alt weeklies did?
It's too bad because we still need those weeklies, I think.
Yeah.
Even if they're just online, if they can't afford the print version. But yes, a lot of documentaries. Look, the documentaries these days that are exciting to watch are the ones that know how to tell a good story and are good at telling the story. So those do very well. I wish we had more documentaries that dealt with current issues that we're facing here in this country. We have a lot of documentaries that are very good at going to other countries and showing the corruption, showing the craziness, showing the death and destruction. Very little of that here. I'm sure it's probably because they think people don't want to go to the movies or turn on Netflix and watch what they can see, you know, two blocks away.
And I think it's easier sometimes to see the story when it's not right in front of you. I mean, that's what is something that you do so well, and what you guys were just talking about, how it's in our own backyard. But sometimes I think that perspective of it
people
being
don't
in
want to escape
country.
To something they're seeing all the time too. That's another thing.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I think I made a film last year, Fahrenheit 11/9, 11/9 being November 9th, the day that Trump was announced that he was president. But we knew when we were making it that people are not going to want to go and sit in a movie theater after working hard all week and dealing with everything about Trump in the news. Now let's watch a two-hour movie about him. No. So, I mean, so there's not a lot of Trump in the movie. There's just enough.
Yeah.
But the stuff with the Flint water and other things like that in the movie, kind of I wanted to show not so much Trump. I'm concerned with how we got Trump.
Right.
He didn't fall out of the sky. He. How did this happen? How do we make sure it doesn't happen again? I want to take care of those parts of our system that allowed Donald Trump to be in this position. Something I've never understand as a Midwesterner is why New York never took care of Trump. Why?
Took care of him.
Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, had that guy, who the way he is, was from Detroit, or Pittsburgh, or Milwaukee, or any of a number of other places I could state, he never would have been foisted on the rest of you, the rest of the country. That he would have been dealt with. The fact that he got away with so much for so many years, and all he was tabloid entertainment to the people of New York.
Yeah, he was a punchline for upper West Side.
The Donald.
Right, the short-fingered vulgarian, right?
Yes, yeah. And he didn't come up with the Donald. That's the Post or the Daily News came up with that, and he loved it.
So, again, you were very prescient about the last election. How do you sort out what's going on with the Democratic field this time around? And I mean, you've said some things that were critical about the Democrats in this election cycle. What's going to happen? And is there any chance at this point to have this be not a mess heading into the primary season?
No.
No, at this point?
Not a mess? Absolutely not. This is going to be the biggest mess. We're not even prepared for what we're going to see here. If I were king of America, I know how I would be conducting things right now. First of all, for the Democrats, you know, I'd be doing with them. Let's just say the last couple debates, you know, every one of them had something good to say. Everybody had something good to say. And you can find your candidate somewhere on that stage. These debates, we don't need any more debates. We kind of know where everybody stands. You know, my recommendation would be a stadium tour in January. Domed because of the weather. But
right.
But do take the candidates. They all come out holding hands, you know, at the beginning. There's a little song and dance. There's something, you know. I'm not suggesting they do a Rockettes line,
right,
18
yeah.
of them. But come out and just get everybody fired up. You know, we don't know which one of us is going to be president, but one of us. You're looking at the next president right now on this stage. And we need to all get excited. We're all going to vote for whoever the winner is. And let's do this, folks. And then give them each 10 to 15 minutes, not talking sound bites,
right,
but present themselves to the American people and what they would do. I think that would be a much better way in the weeks leading up to Iowa and New Hampshire. Having said that, that will not happen, by the way, my suggestion. I think, honestly, here's the thing. I think if the election were held tonight across the country, Trump would win. Trump would win. Not in the popular vote. Oh, no. Hillary won by 3 million votes. Whoever the Democrat is next year is going to win by 4 to 5 million popular votes. The gap will be even larger.
But it's California and New York.
That's right. But nobody's staying home.
Right.
No, because too many Californians and New Yorkers always say, well, we don't really have a say in this. You know, we never get to, oh, they are going to have a say. They're going to want to have a say. They're going to want their, they will stand in line for 3 hours to vote next year in California and New York. And Democrats who live in Texas and Louisiana and Alabama, where they would stay home before because what's the point? Alabama's never going to go. They're going to be there. So the popular vote is going to be huge for the Democrat. But I got to tell you, and I'm sure you've seen this, you've written about it, that Trump has not lost his loyal base.
No, they've gotten bigger, right?
They've gotten bigger and angrier and whiter and madder. And, I see it. I see it in Michigan. Even though we flipped it last November, we got rid of all the Republicans in Lansing. I mean, the top, the governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, and attorney general. We replaced those four with a black man, a single mom, a lesbian, and a woman who's the governor. So no white men, no white straight men anywhere around the levers of power.
Safe space.
Safe space for everyone. Come to Michigan. Yeah. Move to Michigan. Because we literally have removed white men, angry white men, no longer have a fucking say in what's going on in Michigan. Now, there's still no legislature and all that. We still have some more work to do. But this has been a good turn. But still, I will tell you this. I think Trump right now would still win only because his base is so rabid, so unturnable. All the time that good liberals have wasted in the last 3 years trying to convince their conservative brother-in-law that Trump's nuts and he shouldn't, that is such a waste. Do not spend another minute between now and next November trying to convince a Trump voter to change. They can't be changed. They can't be turned.
Well, but couldn't, I mean, isn't Bernie's argument, though, that you can reach some of those voters?
He's already reached them. The ones who were going to turned in that first year.
Right.
And I think yes, that's, but now, if you're still, think about this, if you're still with Trump after witnessing these 3 years, man, that's, I know a lot of these guys, the white guys who voted for him in Michigan, it's not because they liked Donald Trump. Right. It's he represented a human Molotov cocktail that they got to throw into the system and blow it up because the system has screwed them.
You know, I learned something today, Matt.
Well, I think we learned a lot of somethings.
I think we learned a lot. It's true what they say. Every day you learn something new. I learned what a great person to chat with Michael Moore is.
Yeah, he's got a lot of stories.
So, yes, he's really, the podcast is great. I got to say, I listened to it. It was great.
And I think he's such an interesting character because he's always occupied this place in the American media landscape with that it's not designed to have a person like him in it.
Right.
He's always had kind of like pseudo-opposition, not even pseudo, he's an oppositional political voice not within the Democratic Party and, you know, against the Republicans.
Right.
So the fact that he's carved out that career and he talked a lot about how he did that over the years, I think that's really, really been interesting. And, you know, he's still doing it, which is cool.
You know what? That chat with Michael Moore was so good. I think our listeners and viewers deserve to hear more of it.
Hear more of it.
Have it stretched out.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They could hear more of it.
They could if we give it to them, which we will. So what we're going to do for Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, all those things, is we're going to give you the gift of more Michael Moore. More Michael
Wow,
Moore.
Wow, amazing puns.
Yes,
just
so good.
Flying
That's
in all
another
directions.
Gift. And so we're going to bring you the rest of the interview with Michael Moore next week. And we think you're going to like it and you're going to learn even more.
Absolutely.
You're going to like the way you look. I guarantee it. Remember that from Men's
I do
Warehouse?
Vaguely remember that. So, yeah, tune in next week.
Yes.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.